for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is David Ness. I'm with the Federal Defenders of Montana out of the Great Falls office. I represent Patricia Ann Larson. Seated at council table is Mr. Jim Obey, who is a private lawyer who represents Mr. Lavender, the co-defendant and co-appellant. In our brief, we raised three separate issues. I submitted 28J letters, I think two 28J letters, on the cross-examination issue, and so I would like to concentrate on that issue today. As the court is aware, during cross-examination of two chief government witnesses, the two cooperating witnesses, Connie Riggs and Mr. Lemire, we attempted to elicit through cross-examination that they were looking at substantial minimum mandatory sentences. We were interrupted in our cross-examination, and the district court precluded us from eliciting that testimony. Specifically, Mr. Lemire was looking at a sentence of life without possibility of parole unless the government moved to reduce his sentence. Now, in determining whether or not a court has placed improper limits on cross-examination, the court looks at essentially two factors, and that is whether the evidence that was excluded was relevant, and whether, assuming that it was relevant, whether or not there were other legitimate interests that would mandate or justify its exclusion. In this case, neither one of those factors.
Well, now, the jury did know something, did it not, with respect to potential sentence?
They really didn't know about the potential sentence.
They knew that these witnesses were exposed to some sort of criminal penalty, were they not?
They knew that, but I think something else that the court needs to key in on here.
Well, what I'm trying to find out is, what did they know, and what more did you think they should have been allowed to hear? Put it that way.
Okay. Well, the jury knew that they were cooperating, pursuant to plea agreements, that the government, if it was satisfied with their testimony, would move to reduce their sentences.
Only the government could do that.
And only the government could do that, except I think that point was somewhat muddled by the court's admonition of me when I was trying to cross-examine the witnesses, when the court said, specifically, not once but twice, sentencing is up to the court. And that I think, muddled the entire issue of whether or not these witnesses were essentially at the mercy of the government. And as I stated in my brief, I think also the court's admonition to me and the jury was in fact a misstatement of the law, because in fact, unless the government did move to reduce these individual sentences, sentencing was not up to the court. Sentencing had been set by Congress.
But that was brought out rather clearly in the cross-examination of Pointreau, wasn't it?
When I tried to do that...
There's only one man in this room who can bring your sentence down, and that's the U.S. attorney.
Right, but right about that same time, the court interjected itself and admonished both myself and the jury that sentencing was solely up to the court. So I think that whole issue of whether or not that there would be a reward here if the government was satisfied became somewhat muddled by the court's admonition.
Well, in a post-Booker world, at least, it's a correct statement, isn't it, that it really is up to the court?
Not in this case, because their sentences were set by statute. What they pled to in the plea agreement exposed Mr. Lemire to a sentence of life without possibility of parole. And that doesn't matter whether it was pre- or post-Booker. That was going to be his sentence unless the government moved to reduce it. Ms. Lemire was looking at a 5-year minimum mandatory sentence. Now, the court could have gone to go above that, but it could not go below that absent the motion from the government. And that's what I was trying to point out to the jury, and that, I think, is something that the jury should have known, especially with Mr. Lemire, who was, I think, the most important government witness, to establish his potential bias, to establish reasons that he might, knowingly or unknowingly, shade his testimony in favor of the government. And I think that that's also something that, had the jury known, they probably would have viewed his testimony in a much different light. So unless there's any other questions, I'll allow Mr. Obey to argue and discuss it with you about his findings.
Mr. Obey, before you start speaking, that clock shows 4:31. That's your total time for your side. So if your co-counsel wants to reserve some rebuttal time, you're going to have to make allowance for that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And could I ask the deputy to add back 30 seconds because your time. There you go.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe Mr. Nessler has broke the record. The fact that our cross-examination was limited certainly affected Mr. Labrador as it affected Ms. Larson in this case, Your Honor. The issue is before the court. Did the court overreach the discretion that it had? And we feel that certainly it did overreach that discretion, Your Honor.
Well, to what extent do we have to take into consideration the other evidence of guilt that was introduced besides that evidence by Lemire and Pointer, in your case, the testimony of Riggs that he purchased from Larson and the police were controlling?
You know, there was other testimony concerning Mr. Labrador and his drug involvement. The testimony came in the form of controlled buys from Mr. Labrador. It only amounted to a few grams, nowhere near the 300-plus grams that the jury found in this case. The evidence for the larger weights came specifically from Ms. Poitras and also Mr. Lemire, Your Honor. They were the prime. They had the big numbers in this case. There was other evidence.
Counsel, on the issue with respect to the defendants not sitting at counsel table, help us sort that out. My understanding is they were sitting directly behind counsel and they had access during the entire trial. Is that a fair assessment or not?
That is correct, Your Honor. If counsel was sitting at this table, as we see to my left here, the defendants were seated directly behind us, there was a marshal on each side of those defendants, Your Honor.
All right. How do we get inference of guilt from that? I don't have an understanding of that.
Well, Your Honor, I think the fact that there's a marshal sitting on each side of your client certainly impresses the jury that this man or lady needs to be controlled in this case. An innocent person sitting there by themselves without an escort, I think, gives a better impression to the jury. If they had been seated at the table with us, certainly there would have been marshals in the area, but not seated directly next to that client, Your Honor.
So it's really more the presence of the marshals that you're concerned about. If they'd just been sitting near you without marshals, would your argument be the same?
The marshal presence plus the fact that we were physically separated from our clients, Your Honor.
Wasn't that because of didn't the judge ask the marshals if that was a good idea?
The judge asked the marshals what their preference was, and the marshals said we would like to have the client sit behind
What deference do we have to give that?
Sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear
What that. Deference do we have to give to the marshals' expertise as to security? Chevron deference?
I think in this case the marshals had no reason to fear anything would happen from these clients. They at no point had been disruptive, caused any commotion, or behaved other than exceptionally well-behaved people, Your Honor. I think the fact that when we're putting a marshal next to a person shows to the jury that this person cannot be trusted. This person needs supervision. I would like to reserve the remaining time.
You may do so, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will hear from the government.
Good morning. My name is Joe Thagard. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Great Falls office. And can everyone hear me all right?
Yes, very well.
All right, thank you. And I prosecuted this matter. I'll address my comments primarily to the issue of the contention that the court improperly limited the defendant's ability to cross-examine Lemire and Poitras. In particular, I would draw the court's attention to Larson's excerpt of the record, page 55, which contains the trial transcript, pages 196 and 197. It is true that the court did not allow Mr. Ness to examine Poitras and Lemaire about the mandatory minimum sentences which they faced, but I think that it's an important sequence of events that takes place here, because what happened was initially defense counsel asked Poitras about the mandatory minimum sentence. The court sustained its own objection, essentially, and then the government followed up with another objection. It was after that that defense counsel inquired of her whether or not it was, in fact, the government only which could make the motion to reduce her sentence. And I think that that is important here, because I think that that tends to dispel the fact that, or the contention that there was some muddling of the power of that latter question about the fact that only the government could make the motion for a reduction of sentence. That occurred after the court had made its comments, after it had sustained the objections about the mandatory minimum. And in looking at the Schoenberg case, it appears that there are three criteria that should be fulfilled in the cross-examination of a defendant about a plea agreement. And those concern what benefit or detriment will flow to the defendant.
Mr. Taggart, on that very question, what benefit will flow to the cooperating witness on the stand, the magnitude of the benefit cannot be assessed by the jury unless they know what sentences are possible without the intervention of the U.S. attorney. Isn't that correct?
Well, I don't know that that's entirely correct, Your Honor. I would note two things. First of all, I think that they're certainly, they're made aware that the critical thing is that a motion can be made by the government and by the government alone. And I'm looking at the Dowdanian case from the Ninth Circuit. It appeared in that case, and I think that it's a factually driven sort of argument that's presented in the Dowdanian, but it appears from that case that they do not necessarily have a categorical right to look into what the maximum sentence is that a defendant faces.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you about a different issue that has not been discussed yet today, and that has to do with the co-conspirator statements. Would you explain to me, in your view, why the statements were made in furtherance of the conspiracy rather than being simply narrative of past activities?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think what was made here in furtherance of this was there were trips to purchase these drugs, and in the course of making these trips, the Labrador and this other individual, Fatso Comiotis, made statements essentially that the drugs were coming from Larson, and those I think. Were made in furtherance or tended to further the conspiracy to the extent that they were apprising Lemaire about the source of those drugs. And that seems to be of significance.
Is there a fair inference that that's an ongoing source, or is it merely in context a past description?
I think it's a fair inference that there's an ongoing source, Your Honor. There were multiple trips which were made in this case, and I think if it were just an isolated incident where Lemire had been told, with respect to one purchase that these drugs were coming from Larson, but that would really be more of a past description. But I think in this instance, it really does show that there's an ongoing course of conduct here, that these people are all involved in a conspiracy to distribute drugs. Labrador was saying where they were coming from. And Judge, since you raised that subject, I'd also would like to point out that if there were error there, I think that it's harmless, because there were additional facts put in evidence in this case, namely the testimony of Riggs that she purchased drugs from Larson, the testimony from Poitras that she had been involved with Labrador, they would call a woman named Patty, and they would then go to Larson's home to purchase the drugs. And I think that certainly, with that powerful sort of evidence, whatever Lemire may have had to say was at best cumulative on that point. Unless the panel has more questions for me, I'll resume my seat.
No further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ness, you have some reserved time, or your side does.
I wanted to, one of the questions that was asked was to what extent should the court take into consideration the other evidence that was presented and the testimony of Riggs in determining, I guess, whether or not the cross-examination issue would be saved through a harmless error analysis. Connie Riggs was never, ever connected up to the alleged conspiracy. Connie Riggs was someone who made one controlled buy, attempted to make another controlled buy that was unsuccessful from Ms. Larson. There was never any evidence that Ms. Riggs had any connection whatsoever to Lemire and to Poitras. And in fact, it was our position all the way through this that the Riggs testimony actually could be viewed favorably towards the defense, because what it established was that Ms. Larson, although she acted as a middle person and helped Ms. Riggs get drugs, after she got the first amount of drugs, which was personal use, she essentially begged Ms. Riggs to give her some. And eventually she was satisfied by getting $10 for her drug. The second time she didn't even know where to get drugs. So the only evidence here really connecting Ms. Larson to this conspiracy was the testimony of Poitras and Lemire.
Thank you, counsel. The case just argued will be submitted for decision. We will now go to the argument in the United States versus...